Okay, that's been at least 30 seconds, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Again, welcome everybody. I'm Representative Andrew Carlson, Chair of the Property and Local Tax Division. So with that, I'll call the Property Tax and Local Tax Division to order. As far as members present, I'm just going to read through the list here. We have Representative Zhang, Representative Runbeck, Representative Petersburg, Representative Marcourt, Representative Vang, Representative Herr, Representative Gomez, Representative Hewitt, and Representative Bernardi are currently present. As other members join us, we'll be sure to recognize them as well. But with that, we do have a quorum. And I'm going to pause here just for a second. And let's see. Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Next on the agenda is, so I'm going to say that with that, we do have a quorum present. Next, Representative Vang is going to move the minutes from the May 1st, 2020 hearing. And I'll give me a second just to unmute everybody. We're going to do a voice vote on the minutes. Okay. All those in favor of the May 1st, 2020 minutes, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, say no. Okay, with that, the minutes are approved. All right. All right, folks. So this is the division report walkthrough, as well as we'll be taking public testimony. To kind of kick things off here, we have House Research to walk us through the bill. And I believe Mr. Swanson is first. So, members, we're not moving anything. There's no motions to be taken here. This is simply all for presentation purposes. I believe we have Mr. Swanson on the line with us from House Research to kind of kick us off. Mr. Swanson, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Oh, and I'm sorry. Jared, I'm going to pause you just for a second. And for the record, Representative Hertas has joined the call as well. So welcome, Representative Hertas. Mr. Swanson, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is Jared Swanson with House Research. We are going to do a walkthrough of the division report, and we will be working off the House Research summary, which should have been sent to members. It has the title HF346DE summary. So I'm going to start with Article 1, Section 1 of the DE Amendment. Section 1 establishes a property tax deferral for an elderly living facility in Duluth. There are a number of requirements outlined in Subdivision 1 of this section, and as long as the facility continues to meet these requirements, the property will be exempt from property taxes. However, if any portion of the property is sold, transferred, or no longer qualifies under Subdivision 1, the property owner would pay back any taxes that have been due on the property over the past 5 years. Section 2 of Article 1 adds to the 4B1 property tax classification short-term rental properties containing less than 4 units that were rented for more than 14 days in the preceding year. The 4B1 classification has a class rate of 1.25%. It is not subject to the state general levy, and the class is subject to referendum market value taxes. Section 3 of Article 1 relates to the Disabled Veterans Homestead Market Value Exclusion. This provision allows a one-time transfer of the exclusion for the spouse of a deceased veteran, provided that the value of the new home does not exceed the value of the original property. Section 4 of Article 1 allows counties to distribute any property tax payments received after the first pass settlement deadline in May for property taxes payable in 2020 only. So this would apply to this would allow counties to establish a second settlement date for first pass property tax payments and then to distribute the funds to local jurisdictions, including cities, towns, and school districts. Counties choosing to do this would be required to file the same state auditor reports that are required for first half payments. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Dalton will walk through the final two sections of Article 1.
Very good. Please proceed.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Well, For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. Article 1, Section 5 is the 2019 aid penalty forgiveness provision for the City of Sargent as amended in the committee hearing last Friday. And Section 6 is the 2019 aid penalty forgiveness for the City of Roosevelt, also as amended last Friday. However, there was one additional technical amendment made to this language that was suggested by the state auditor. We removed the requirement for a 2019 audit because the city is so small, it does not actually have to file an audit. And that completes Article 1.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Ms. Dalton, I believe you are still on deck here to present portions of Article 2. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We're going to take Article 2 a little out of order. I'm going to present Sections 1 and 5 through 8, and then Ms. Hagler will, when I'm done, will talk about Sections 2 to 4, and then she will finish with Articles 3 and 4 as well.
Okay. And members, I'm going to pause there just for a second, just to kind of capture any member questions. I think that might be best just to kind of break this into chunks. So any questions on Article 1? Also, want to recognize that Representative Draskowski has joined us as well so that we can get him marked for the minutes as well. And then, members, if you have questions, please text Mr. Jessen. He'll get you on the list. Not seeing any members' questions yet. We can always come back, but I thought I'd just give folks a chance. Ms. Dalton, why don't you proceed with your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Starting with Section 1 in Article 2, what this section does is effectively impose a moratorium on new local sales taxes being proposed during the 2021 legislative session, and it does this by requiring that the necessary resolution for proposing the tax be passed in the 12-month period prior to the start of the session, and then prohibiting any local government from passing a resolution from March 1, 2020 until July 1, 2021. And during this time period, there will be a study looking at actually defining criteria and the types of projects. And I'll talk about that when I get to Section 8. Moving on to Section 5 of the bill. It's on page 4 of the summary. It's on the top of page 18 in the bill. This relates to the local lodging taxes. It states that local lodging taxes will apply to the whole price of lodging, including services provided by accommodations intermediaries. This language has been heard several times over the years. This does not include the provision that was in the original bill heard this year that would have made this retroactive. It is only effective going forward, and it is silent on any retroactive collections. Section 6 of Article 2 is the provision that has also been around for a number of years that says that a local government that is imposing a lodging tax can choose to limit the required filing and remittance of the tax by accommodation intermediaries to once a year, but requires that the collection date has to coincide with the monthly filing date for state taxes. Section 7 is part of the flexibility bill amendment that was heard in committee last Friday. It allows local governments temporary authority to divert a portion of certain local sales taxes to their general fund through December 31st, 2021. It applies to unencumbered revenues from general sales taxes, food and beverage, liquor, lodging, and admissions. It requires that before a local government diverts the money, they must have a plan and they must hold a public hearing on the plan prior to the diversion of the funds. And then Section 8 is the study group or the working group that I mentioned when I was discussing Section 1. It is a local sales tax criteria working group. It is made up of the Commissioner of Revenue, representatives from various local government groups, and individuals representing the metro, the non-metro, Main Street retailers, and internet sellers. Those last four would be appointed by the governor. The group must develop a list of capital projects that could qualify as a project of regional significance, and then develop criteria for each of those capital projects to use in judging whether it does qualify. The group must also develop a list of capital projects that should not be considered as projects of regional significance for local sales tax purposes, either because the project would is generally funded through other means by other local governments, or because it is a project that would be funded by the local government even if it had no non-residents using the project. The study group is required to provide a report by November 1, 2021, outlining these lists, the criteria, and any proposed legislation needed to codify their findings. And this report must be sent to the ranking members of the House and Senate committees with jurisdiction over local sales taxes. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Hagler.
Before we get to Ms. Hagler, thank you, Ms. Dalton. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. But I do want to pause for just a moment here and share with members some thoughts on the local option sales tax moratorium as well as the study group. These issues have been discussed at length, but, of course, the language here is new. We heard over 20 local sales tax proposals this year. And they were all over the map, literally and figuratively. We're now placed in a position of trying to determine whether certain proposals contain capital projects as well as a regional scope or significance without the benefit of a set of criteria to follow beyond what the statute says. So any decisions that are made could easily be viewed as subjective. What this language does, it basically hits pause on local sales taxes and to allow for local governments to come up with a criteria of determining what does qualify as a capital project and what qualifies as having regional significance. Those are terms we used repeatedly when we were hearing these, and it seems like we're always kind of coming up with some a shifting definition. By putting city and county groups in charge of the study, they would have that would set clear criteria to follow when submitting their local option sales tax proposals to the legislature. It would be city and county groups that came up with the criteria. They would have some ownership in the decisions being made. This would increase transparency and objectivity in the decision-making process and approving these local option sales tax. Otherwise, I fear that the criteria would vary from one year to the next, and it would, of course, be the opposite of transparency and objectivity. In addition, the benefit of hitting pause now with the local option sales tax is that there's other language in the division report that significantly opens up the use of local sales taxes. Without other changes, local option sales tax proposals would be approved by voters and not knowing how those dollars could be used. So they would be going to the polls and vote for an increase in local option sales tax for a specific purpose without any of the revenue going to that specific purpose until 2022. So these are not easy decisions. It's going to be important that we work with cities and counties to figure out what the best solutions are. That's why the working group and the study are being proposed, so that we can get their feedback and input on this going forward. So I'm sure there'll be more discussion on this as we continue our conversation here today, but I just wanted to provide some further context for members as we start to get some questions around this. So with that, I will stop. And Ms. Hagler, I believe you're on the phone as well. If you could pick up where we left off on the review of the division report, please.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I keep interrupting you. I'm so sorry. We do have some folks that have that would like to ask a question. Let's just take those real quick here before we move on. Ms. Segal, I'm so sorry. One moment. Our first question is from Representative Petersburg. Representative Petersburg, if you would please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to take a lot of time because I know we'll have more time to debate this in another couple of days. But it does seem like we've changed the rules on getting local option sales tax approved 1 year and then the next. And I'm concerned that we have kind of left people in the middle saying before it used to be that they had to have approval first, then come to the state. And then we changed that where they said they'd come to the state first and then get approval. Now we're going back again. And some of these projects have some time crunch to them. And so I just have a little bit of a concern and caution that we're kind of bouncing the ball back and forth. And that creates a lot of apprehension and angst. So food for thought, and we'll have more debate, I think, in another couple of days. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Representative Petersburg. Your point is well taken. This was not a decision that was taken lightly, and we definitely are sensitive to the needs that are out there. Next on the list, I have Representative Marquardt, or Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And so, this has been a discussion that's probably gone back several years and with a lot of different changes to statutes, but you know, when there was just a couple coming in, it really wasn't even that big of a deal. But the last few years when we've had 20 to 24 local option sales taxes, it's become kind of a whole new animal, if you will. And, you know, I think when we heard all of them this year, which I think, Mr. Chair, is quite a credit to you to hear all, whatever it was, 24 of those bills, you know, members' questions and concerns and comments really kind of said, we really don't know. You know, it created a lot of problems. So hopefully this group will look at, you know, what is regional? What is truly regional? Is it something that is truly benefiting the region, or are other regional cities just paying for the cost through higher sales tax when they go into that city? And you know, also, you know, so how do you define that? And usually some of the things mentioned, too, is, you know, funding sources. Is this something that could be funded by another state agency or some other way that the city would have? And, you know, what type of project? I mean, is it going to be buildings or are streets regional or sewer and water regional if it's below ground versus above ground? So I think there's just a lot of things that I think we need really good clarity on. Otherwise, right now, if you were to pick whatever that might be out of the 24, there'd just be a lot of questions, too. Why didn't mine make it? Why didn't? I just think we need a lot more clarity, and hopefully this group will do that. And I don't know if it's the charge of the group, but I would like to see the group to kind of look a little bit at the probably the biggest question that I have, the most overreaching one, is, you know, how does local government aid, which was supposed to be the great equalizer, how is that now when you've got this local option sales tax coming in that I think somewhat upsets that apple cart? And so I think probably this year the fact is that we have a new law, new criteria in place. It might be a good time to do it, actually, because we really haven't authorized any bills under the new law. So if there's probably a good time to do it, it might be for this. But as Representative Petersburg mentioned, I mean, you know, it's nothing's perfect on any of this, and there will be questions. But I do think this is probably a good time to really have groups sit down and really look at this issue overall. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Chair Marquardt. So not to belabor the issue, we can always come back to this through further testimony, too. We're going to continue for the much-anticipated presentation by Ms. Hagler. Ms. Hagler, if you would please proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, this is Alex Hagler from House Research. So I'm just going to go back to page 3 of the summary and start with Article 2, Section 2. This provision authorizes the transfer of unobligated increment to the municipality's general fund. This portion of the bill was heard on Friday in the committee, and some changes were made to the language between now and then, including some suggestions made by the state auditor's office. For example, the provision now requires that the TIF authority amends its TIF plan in accordance with the spending plan. Also, the provision requires that the authority send the modified TIF plan and the adopted spending plan to the state auditor's office so they can monitor those situations. The language also now includes the requirement that transferred increment be spent by December 31, 2021, or if that's not possible, at least have adopted a plan on how the increment will be spent by that date. And then lastly, the provision now will require that any increment that is improperly received is not eligible for transfer. And the provision still does retain the requirement that the spending plan is approved by the municipality after holding a public hearing. Section 3 of the bill extends the five-year pooling rule to 10 years for redevelopment districts outside of the metro area. This was the bill that was also heard last Friday. And then Section 4 was added also at the suggestion of the state auditor so that the six-year rule requiring that increment be spent on activities to decertify the district, typically that would start in the sixth year of a district. However, if the five-year pooling rule is being extended this year, this rule must also be extended for those redevelopment districts, so it'll be from 6 years to 11 years. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Thank you. And, Ms. Hagler, I believe you are also kind of our closer with Articles 3 and 4. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Proceed when you're ready.
Okay. Article 3 is from the Department's Policy and Technical Bill, and we're now on page 5 of the summary. As a reminder, the property tax-related articles from the Department's bill were contained in House File 3567, and members may recall that the bill was amended to remove one provision relating to property tax refunds and certificates of rent paid. That provision was sent to the Civil Law Committee and didn't return to be heard in taxes this session, so that provision is not contained in the division report. However, Article 3 contains the provisions that were formerly in Article 1 and 3 of the Department's Policy and Technical Bill, and no changes were made. And the provisions in here include provisions that are related to Board of Assessor education requirements, the powers and duties of county and city assessors, some clarifications regarding the wind and solar energy production tax, and then some technical clarifications for cross-references to certain PILT payments. And that is Article 3. Mr. Chair and members, Article 4 is also from the Department of Revenue's Policy and Technical Bill. As you may recall, in 2019, the fire and police state aid provisions of statute were recodified in the department's bill, and this Article 4 is related to that recodification, and no changes were made from the department's bill into this bill. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 4.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. I appreciate it. Ms. Schill, I think you're last on my list of presenters with regards to walking us through the spreadsheet.
Yes, Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Perfect. For the record, my name is Kathy Schill, and I'm with House Fiscal Analysis, and we'll be working from House File 346 DE Fiscal Spreadsheet that you all should have received from Mr. Justin or received online. It is a one-page spreadsheet, and I will start at the very top where you'll see that this spreadsheet refers to House File 346-DE, that is the A20-0760 Division Report, as presented to Division. It has a date in the right-hand corner of 5-1-2020. Mine's, and before I go into the detail, I will draw your attention to line 6. Note, positive numbers are program expenditures and revenue losses, and negative numbers are a cost. What we're doing is tracking the costs as other division bills would have spending. So beginning with line 1 under general fund summary, this is budgeted numbers from the February 2020 forecast for fiscal 2021. Expenditures are expected to be $3,872,178, and for fiscal 2023, $4,170,233. Line 2 of the summary shows the proposed changes here in this sheet. Zero changes from all of these items. There are 11 in total for the fiscal 2021 period. And for fiscal 22-23, you'll see a cost reduction of $160,000. Total spending would be, once again, $3,872,178 for fiscal 2021, and fiscal 22-23, $4,170,073. The bulk of what you see for the changes of expenditures are reflected in lines 5 through 10. Three items in particular have property tax refund changes. It's income refund or income tax interactions. And three bills, House File 3826 as amended, Representative Eklund's bill. This is the short-term rental provision that was discussed in Article 1. This is a change for the new Class 4B1. You'll see that there's an unknown impact in the tails in actually fiscal 2023. On line 9, you'll see House File 552 as amended, Representative Schultz Elderly Living Facility exempted for property taxation. Once again, the impact is in the tails, negligible in each fiscal 22 and 23. And then finally, on line 10, you'll see the inclusion of the spouse of deceased disabled veteran, the market value exclusion, the one-time transfer of the exclusion, has once again a cost savings in the tails for a total of a savings of $160,000. I forgot to mention I have a column which reflects the effective dates for each of these provisions, which is important because some of these have been written so that the impact does fall in the tails as opposed to the current year. As we travel down the spreadsheet, the other portions that you'll see is what Ms. Dalton referred to under aids and credits. These LGA penalty forgiveness provisions, City of Sargent and for the City of Roosevelt, those are already appropriated, and what we're doing is that they miss the distribution, and we're reaching back before the end of the fiscal year. And when we do that before June 30th, there is no impact. And then finally, you have a summary of items on lines 24 through 35, which have no state impact. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes the summary of the spreadsheet.
Well, thank you, Michelle. That was very succinct. Thank you for your presentation. Members, any questions for staff on the bill before us? I'm going to pause there for just a second. If you want to text Mr. Jessen with any, get in the queue for that. Just a little housekeeping as we move forward. We will. That was the last for the presentation of the bill. We're now going to get into public testimony, and we will be pausing at the end of each presenter. Hopefully each presenter can keep their comments brief to allow for chance for member questions, but we'll be taking questions after each testifier so that we still have that person on the line, and it makes for easy how we have to mute and unmute people. So I'm not seeing any questions on the presentation so far, so we're going to keep going here. First for my testifiers is Mr. Matt Hilgart. Is Matt on the line?
Hi, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Sure can. How's it going?
Good, thanks. I'm glad this is working out.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah. Thank you for joining us. You can introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. My name is Matt Hilgart, and I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties, and AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. If you don't mind, I'll just speak to one specific item in tonight's bill, and then be on hand if members have any questions on how some of these provisions might impact counties later on. The issue that I wanted to speak to tonight is in support of a provision in Article 1, Section 4, and that is the additional property tax element. As Mr. Swanson stated, this provision would allow counties to make an additional settlement outside their current property tax settlement structure. And why, just to provide members a little context on why this is important, is that right now you have approximately 24-plus counties who have acted on providing property tax relief at a local level. And one of the concerns that counties have, as well as other local taxing jurisdictions, is what happens if there's a delay in property tax penalties. What would the utilization of this delay be by property taxpayers, and how would that affect local cash flows? Right now, counties have an extremely tailored timeline on when they can provide tax settlement distributions to other local districts. So the county collects the taxes, and then they send those taxes out within a certain time frame to townships, school districts, cities, et cetera. The concern, of course, comes into effect if a county pushes back that delay or that penalty to a certain point that falls outside those settlement process, which would mean that instead of a township or city getting their portion of the property tax settlement in June or July, they might have to wait till the next settlement process, which would be November. So you can see how that would be extremely, rather than just a two-month disruption to cash flow, you'd be looking at half a year or more. So this very simple, non-glamorous, but importantly, no-cost item is extremely important for local governments as we try to do what's right and provide relief during this COVID era. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will just stay on the line if there's any questions, and I'll stay on for the entire conversation just in case on some of these other provisions folks have questions or concerns on how it impacts counties, if that's okay with you.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. I do appreciate it. Members, please indicate if you have a question for Mr. Hilgart with regards to his testimony. I'll give you guys a minute if you do. On deck here, I have Mr. Gary Carlson is next. So if Gary's on the line, we'll get him queued up here as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Gary, good to see you, or good to hear you. I don't think there's any questions for Mr. Hilgart, so Mr. Carlson, if you want to proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify on the Delete All Amendment to House File 346. I'm not going to speak about the revenue flexibility provisions that are contained in the bill, that were outlined in Article 2, Section 2 and Article 2, Section 7, because we submitted a letter jointly between the League of Minnesota Cities, Metro Cities, and the Municipal Legislative Commission indicating our support for those changes. So we appreciate working with the state auditor to clarify and make those work better. So thank you for that. I would like to speak on a few other sections in the Delete All Amendment. As Mr. Hilgart just indicated, Article 1, Section 4 that allows an extra payment from the counties to local units of government is going to be increasingly important. We know that not only are 24 counties considering or have decided to waive penalties, we do believe that because of the unique economic circumstances, we're going to see a greater share of taxpayers just unable to make their payments on time, regardless of whether their counties are enacting a waiver of the penalty. So we think this is an important way to make sure cities' cash flow can be maintained and they can make their commitments for salary and bond payments that do come up in August. I'd like to thank you for including the Sargent and Roosevelt provisions in the bill. Although we don't have a specific position on those, we do work closely with the Office of the State Auditor to make sure all cities comply with their reporting requirements. And I think in some years we've had many more than two cities that have been unable to comply, but we do appreciate you making those adjustments and allowing their aides to be paid. Then in Article 2, Sections 3 and 4, this is the base bill that Representative Petersburg authored on the extension of the five-year rule for redevelopment TIF districts in Greater Minnesota. We don't have a specific position at the League on that. However, in 2009, we did testify in support of a 5 to 10 year extension for redevelopment and renewal and renovation districts that was put in place because of the impact of the Great Recession. And then again, I think it was in 2014, we also supported an extension of the five-year rule to 8 years for redevelopment districts. And those last two provisions applied across the state. I know that two cities have submitted five-year rule extensions from the metro area that would not be impacted by Article 2, Sections 3 and 4. That would be Ramsey and Maple Plain. And I suspect that you'll probably next session get a lot of additional legislative requests to extend the five-year rule due to the extenuating circumstances and the slowdown of the economy. So you might want to consider either this year or next year just doing a blanket extension like you did in 2009 and in 2014. Then on Article 2, Sections 5 and 6, the League supports the clarification of the lodging taxes collected directly by local units of government to have that tax apply to the entire consideration that includes the online intermediaries. And I know, Mr. Chair, this is your original bill. The League does have a position supporting this clarification to make the application of local lodging taxes identical to the way the state sales tax applies and the sales, the lodging taxes that are collected by the state for cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul. And then finally, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to express a couple of concerns with the moratorium on the local sales taxes. Although we don't lobby on specific local sales taxes, I have heard from many of the cities that did have those requests. They are a bit frustrated. You've seen a couple of letters come in and a few other emails indicating the frustration that their proposals, although following the existing rules, no longer will be considered this session. So I just want to echo that. But I would like to say that the League is willing to work and participate in the work group that is created under Article 2, Section 8. In fact, I've already had a couple of city officials who read through the bill and have said they would volunteer to participate. So we will be standing ready to assist you if this does become law. So with that, Mr. Chair, I guess I just mentioned one other thing. We did have a moratorium on local sales taxes. Ms. Dalton will remember that, and maybe Representative Marquardt will remember back in 2008, I think it was, we enacted a moratorium on local sales taxes, and that occurred in a year when we had seven local sales tax proposals that were offered up, and that moratorium lasted about 2 years. However, I know there were some adjustments made to other local sales taxes during that time frame. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would stand for any questions, and I will stay online as well as Mr. Hilgart to respond to any further questions that come down as we go through testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Appreciate your testimony. I do have a member here signed up. Representative Draskowski, you're first on my list. If you would like to proceed with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a quick question and then a comment. The question would be for Ms. Schill. I'm wondering if she could review for us. I was looking at the spreadsheet from the division report. And we do see that from from fiscal 20 to 21 up to through 2022 to 23, there's a $300 million increase in the base, basically. If she could just review for us what those main drivers are and the amounts, if she happens to have them, or at least a list of what the main drivers are.
Okay. Michelle, did you catch that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I will need to pull up my spreadsheet from last session, and if you would give me a moment to do that, but I would say the bottom line is that, as you perhaps recall, we had a number of increases in aid to both LGA and CPA, and as I recall correctly, we've got probably a total of five different aids that came close to $900 million of an increase, and those were to take effect in fiscal 2021. If you need more detail than that, I will need to get that other spreadsheet up, and I have my screen filled with spreadsheets right now. Does that get close, Representative Drazkowski, or should I look further?
It does. If you happen to find it by the time I'm done making this comment, then maybe you, if it's okay with the chair, maybe you could fill us in with that. But otherwise, I will wait till we're COVID released here, and we can actually talk more about it then. Mr. Chair, if I may, just a quick comment.
Yes, absolutely. Please proceed.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I think it's. I think it's, as Chair Marquardt pointed out, I think if you're going to switch back on the local option sales tax, which I do agree with, and I think maybe switching it the other way last year was a mistake. But if you're going to do that, and then we're going to defer the decision essentially to a working group of the of largely the individuals who want to increase local option sales tax or propose new ones in their communities, I think we're going to get more than we have now. And foxes guarding the hen house kind of crosses my mind. So I just saw that and I just kind of went, holy cow. I don't know that. I wonder if there's a different way to do that and actually, bring it back directly to us instead of these groups who are we're going to be asking for more. My experience has been each one of these will be ringing up more of them. So that was my comment.
Well, thank you, Representative Drazkowski. And I think just to that point, it wouldn't be changing the need for municipalities to still submit an application. And before they would go to a referendum, they would still have to get the legislative approval first. But the hope is that by having some buy-in from the immediate stakeholders in defining what the criteria is, my hope is that they would certainly self-select that if they don't meet that base level criteria based on the merits, that they would opt for some other viable funding source. So I'm actually hopeful for the opposite, that through by providing greater clarity in terms of what the expectation is, we actually would receive less applications. But, that's why I don't gamble, I guess. All right. Seeing no other member questions, let me just get back to my list here. I was flipping through spreadsheets, too, while we were having that discussion. Next on my list, I have Mr. Bradley Peterson. Is Mr. Peterson on the line?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Yeah, welcome. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Very good. Again, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bradley Peterson, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Want to thank you for the opportunity to testify remotely on the division report. And we recognize that there's nothing about our current circumstances here that makes any of this work or the decisions that you have to make easy. I first want to offer our voice of support to the revenue flexibility provisions contained in Article 2, Section 2 and 7, respectively, related to the TIF and special tax proceeds. We appreciate that flexibility. And then we also want to lend our voice of support to the extension of the pooling rule from 5 years to 10 for redevelopment districts in greater Minnesota. We appreciate that as well. About some of the concerns that we have related to how local option sales taxes are being handled, and I think some of what's being proposed here with the sales tax working group. Acknowledging, you know, Representative Marquardt and Representative Carlson's concerns about, you know, how these have maybe been done in the past and what are the standards and how can you make decisions that are transparent and fair. I think first off, though, we do find the wholesale moratorium on bringing sales tax resolutions to the legislature until July 2021 pretty problematic. I do know that, as you've heard from a number of cities and counties already, and the cities that brought sales taxes to the legislature this year did so after a significant legislative change to the process and substance last year. And so they were surprised by the scope of those changes, but they did everything that they could to fit their local needs into this new process. And so I think it's very problematic that these cities that felt like they were playing by the rules, brought their proposals in good faith, and now won't have an opportunity to work on them or advance them for a couple of years as it is. I think the fact that the rules changed as dramatically as they did last year, and we now appear to be set up for a pretty significant for those cities is pretty whiplash-inducing. And so, Mr. Chair and members, as we move here, I do hope that we can have further discussion about how we can accommodate and evaluate those cities that brought their sales taxes this year under the rules passed last year by the legislature, that if we can make some space either in the discussion still this year in a special session that will probably be to come, or even during the 2021 session, I think that would be extremely helpful and fair, and we would appreciate that opportunity for those cities. Secondly, to the issue of the sales tax working group, we certainly welcome the opportunity to serve on a work group and appreciate the inclusion of CGMC in this effort. We do have a couple of concerns, though, about kind of the charge and timeline for the group as it's proposed here in the legislation. You know, understanding that what you're trying to get at is greater transparency, clarity, surety for these decision-making processes, I'm afraid that some of the language in the charge to the work group will create an unworkable, narrow, and inflexible structure that will exclude meritorious and important projects, and that will probably sooner rather than later force the legislature into writing a lot of notwithstanding clauses into proposed sales tax bills. An example of this would be the language starting at line 20.27, that asks the work group to surmise what the, quote, allowed size, number of buildings, maximum geographic area, et cetera, for a single project should be. I guarantee you that if you say that three buildings is the allowed maximum, you're going to have a dynamite project that has four buildings that you may have to say no to. And so we'd like to work with the committee to create a charge to the working group that has fidelity to the legislature's intent as passed last year, but is also not so narrow as to be unworkable. And I think we have some ideas about that, Mr. Chair and members, that we'd like to forward along here in the next day or so. Our second, a report.
Mr. Chair.
Pearson,
we lost you for a second there, but we can hear you now, so please proceed.
Okay. Our second major concern is with the timeline of the report. We would recommend that a report is due closer to July 1st, 2021, so that cities have time to shape their proposals for 2022 session in a manner more in line with the recommendations of the report. We think that that would give cities more time to put together a better proposal for 2022 if they're bringing one at that time. So, Mr. Chair and members, appreciate your time and the work that you're doing to bolster cities in the wake of this pandemic On the sales tax side, we are eager to work with you to see if we can do something for those cities that followed the rules in bringing a sales tax proposal this year, and we look forward to working with you to craft a working group that will yield an outcome that both the legislature and local governments can be comfortable with. And with that, I say thank you, and we'll happily stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. And of course, we absolutely look forward to working with you as well. Members, any questions, please text Mr. Justin. He'll get you on the list. I'm not seeing any questions currently. Give folks just a second. But yes, Mr. Peterson, if you could please stay on the line in case we do have some member questions for you, that would be appreciated. We'll keep going then. Next on my list of testifiers is Mr. Joel Carlson. Joel, are you on the line?
Good evening, Mr. Chair.
Good evening. Joel, if you want to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here speaking to you on behalf of Travel Tech, which is an association of travel agents and both online and hardline travel agencies. I do a lot of work in the tourism industry, and there are a number of people that are affected by this change. This issue is certainly not a new one. It's not the Keep Joel Carlson Fully Employed bill, but it has been around since 2009 when it was first introduced into the legislature. In 2011, the legislature in special session had a long debate about extending the sales tax to a number of services. And while very few of them were actually adopted in 2011, my clients were one of the unfortunate ones, and we became, for the first time, subject to state sales tax for the service that travel agents provide when arranging lodging. And I miss my brethren, Gary Carlson, dearly, but I have to disagree with him. This is not just an issue about online travel companies. I provided in a memo the definition of what an accommodation intermediary is for the committee so that you know this is any person or entity that arranges for lodging. And that includes convention and booking groups, tour groups, realtors, vacation home rentals like Airbnb and VRBO, anyone who arranges travel as a travel agent is subject to paying the state sales tax to the state. The Revenue Department has confirmed that all of those businesses are subject to the state sales tax. So I want you to know that we're not talking about just online travel companies, and that misperception has permeated this debate for all these years, but that's just simply not true. And while the legislature did impose a sales tax on travel agents in 2011, they never imposed the local lodging tax on these services. Local lodging taxes are paid for by those who furnish lodging to the public, of which travel agents do not. And there are a lot of practical and even legal problems with trying to impose this tax on non-local businesses. The way this has been set up, it basically allows the municipality to pick which taxpayers they want to choose by sending them a notice that their taxes due, and they can ignore a whole segment of property or of local lodging tax payers and only focus on one or two, and that's just an unequal application, and we think that's unfair. You know, the other thing that is important to remember is that travel agents provide, and those that arrange accommodations provide an important service to the tourism industry. And in many instances, that service is free for the lodging establishment. They don't pay to be on that website. They don't pay for the service to get their property marketed out there. And imposing a new tax on the travel industry, which has been as impacted as any industry in the country over the COVID-19 outbreak, we think is just unfair and unwarranted at this time. Every dime of lodging tax is paid. There is no avoidance of the tax, and travel agents pay their sales tax to the state for the service that they provide. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I will be happy to answer questions, and I appreciate all that you and everyone is doing during this very difficult time.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Members, any questions, please, once again, send a text to Mr. Jessen. Ms. Dalton, while we're kind of waiting for perhaps some member questions here, I have a quick question for Ms. Dalton. And I think Mr. Carlson said this as well. Aren't online intermediary companies already collecting state and local taxes under the current law?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. They are collecting all local general sales taxes, and they are collecting lodging taxes for four local governments where the state is actually doing the lodging tax collection on behalf of those local governments.
Okay.
It's not quite – I beg to disagree with Mr. Carlson on the impact on travel agents. Maybe the way that to think about this is lodging taxes are paid by the customer of the lodging. And the tax should be on the full price of the lodging that that customer pays. And that is why accommodations intermediaries are, that's the policy behind this provision. It's basically saying if you go directly to the lodging and pay a price, or you go through a lodging intermediary and pay a price, the lodging tax paid by the customer should be the same rate based on how much they are paying.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one of the problems of having to work remotely like this is that we are precluded from having a full and robust debate about some of these issues. But just so you know,
sure.
I do disagree with Ms. Dalton and her assessment of the tax situation. I also disagree that that all travel intermediaries are paying, even in those four cities. There are very few travel intermediaries that are even registered with the state as taxpayers. So we don't need to go down that path remotely, but I just want you to know that I do disagree with that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We are going to move on to our next testifier. I have Mr. Paul Egger next on the list. Paul, are you on the line?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Well, hello. Welcome. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Egger, and I am Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to offer some brief testimony on a couple of items that are in the division report. Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for including language in Article 1, Section 2 of the division report addressing the classification of properties where short-term rental has occurred. If the legislature does not act on this issue and counties around the state have to implement guidance that was issued by the Department of Revenue last May, many property owners around the state will see a significant increase in their property taxes. And there will be a county-by-county patchwork of methods for determining primary use of those properties that have been rented on a short-term basis. Also, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for modifying the effective date that was before this committee earlier in House File 3826, which was an issue that was identified both by Representative Eklund and a variety of stakeholders as being problematic. However, Mr. Chair, we also have concerns about other aspects of this provision. We do oppose the 14-day threshold that's currently in the division report, which you can find on page 3, lines 1 and 2 of the Delete Everything Amendment. We think that threshold is too low and will result in a lot of properties being reclassified to 4B, even though the primary use of the property is residential, homestead, or seasonal recreational. Property owners should not have their homes or cabins classified as short-term rental based on 2 weeks of use for that property during the calendar year. We ask that you amend the 14-day threshold to at least 30 days. We're also concerned that the bill applies to homestead property where the property is the owner's residence, and they offer a room or the entire property for rent on a short-term basis during the year. We do not think any homestead property that is the owner's primary residence should be subject to reclassification. The Department of Revenue's May 2019 guidance to all county assessors states, quote, do not change the classification of homestead property if short-term rental occurs and the property remains the owner's slash relative's primary place of residence. We would respectfully ask that you amend the division report moving forward to incorporate that standard for homestead property. And finally, Mr. Chair, Minnesota Realtors does want to join Mr. Carlson in sharing our concerns with the language in Article 2, Sections 5 and 6, which is the provision applying local lodging taxes to the services provided by accommodation intermediaries. We do have members who work in all aspects of housing, from representing buyers and sellers in the purchase of a home or a commercial property to brokering the sale of lodging and vacation or short-term rentals. We do not support expanding the reach of local lodging taxes to the services provided by travel intermediaries, whether they are online travel companies or local individuals working with a few vacation rental property owners. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. Appreciate your time today. Members, once again, questions, email Mr. Jessen. Just out of respect for everybody's time, we've got two more testifiers. Next on the list is Mr. Shane Runling. Shane, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. If you would please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name for the record is Shane Rudlang, and I represent the Bloomington Port Authority and the City of Bloomington. You've heard me testify on the local lodging tax provision before, so I will keep it relatively brief. I'd just like to say that in this time of extreme impact to the lodging industry, especially in Minnesota, we believe it's time to support Minnesota hoteliers, Minnesota cities, Minnesota Convention and Visitors Bureaus, and not the online travel intermediary industry that with limited Minnesota ties. Simply put, the current statute handles the tax base for normal Department of Revenue collected sales tax differently than the tax base for local lodging tax. And this current change offered in the bill by the chair is supported by Hospitality Minnesota and many other BCBBs, as well as Minnesota hoteliers. There is a streamlined sales tax governing board that exists, which, among other things, maintains a list of reputable companies that provide this sales tax remittance service for lots of different sales on the Internet. And there's a whole long list of companies. Alvera is one example I spoke to recently. I'd like to reiterate again that there's no cost of this to the state of Minnesota, and we urge the community to support local Minnesota hoteliers, cities, and CBBs. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
All right. Short and sweet. Thank you, Mr. Runling. All right. Our last but certainly not least testifier for today is Mr. Matt Asman. Matt, if you're on the line, when you get a chance. Oh, great. You're unmuted. Wonderful.
I am on the line.
Wonderful. If you could please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Well, good evening, Mr. Chair and members. I am Matt Mossman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this evening on House File 3346 and all the work that you're doing to move the legislation forward. Our members echo the comments made earlier by AMC and LMC in support of the language of Article 1, Section 4, allowing counties to distribute property tax payments received after the first half settlement day in May 2020 through this calendar year only. Many MICA counties have taken initiative to abate property tax penalties to help taxpayers impacted by COVID by allowing the taxes due on the 20th to be paid at a later date without penalty or with reduced penalty. And those decisions that have been made and in some cases are in the process of being made have all been in consultation with the cities and other taxing jurisdictions in those areas in recognition of the cash flow and the budget implications of delaying collection and distribution. So we really appreciate the House's work. Can you hear me, Mr. Chair members?
We sure can.
Yep. Sorry, I have another call coming in on my phone, so I got a little confused by that. So we appreciate the committee's work to provide a common framework for counties to make those additional distributions as we work through helping property taxpayers during the COVID crisis. I also want to touch base briefly on Article 2, Section 2, which is the excess TIF increment provision. Both state and local budgets will be facing difficult challenges ahead with declining revenues and likely increased demand for services as well. And so with that awareness, we very much understand and appreciate the goal of Article 2, Section 2 to allow excess TIF revenues to be deposited in the general revenue accounts of cities. But we do encourage members to consider retaining current law that already allows tax increment excess tax increment to be distributed back to counties, cities, and schools to help all those jurisdictions that are facing budget challenges in the coming months and days ahead to moderate property tax levies for taxing authorities. So, Mr. Chair and members, I would leave it at that. We do recognize, obviously, that while most Minnesotans live in cities, all Minnesotans also live in a county, or all Minnesotans that live in a city live in a county and a school district as well. And we think that maintaining current law and excess increment distribution will be beneficial to all taxpayers. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions. We recognize that we're really on the front edge of what is going to be significant state budget and local property tax challenges ahead, and we look forward and stand ready to continue working with members of the committee, local partners, state government, and others to help see our way through these budget challenges, and happy to take any questions. Thank you for the time.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mossman. I appreciate your testimony today. That is all I have for testifiers. Members, questions? Pause here a second just to give members a chance to indicate if they have a question. Okay. All right. I'm not seeing any. Members, as far as wrap up, this is what we have for the week ahead. Again, I want to thank you for your work today. We'll be back here on Wednesday at 4:15 p.m. Okay, and I've just been notified that Representative Hertas has a question. I'll hold off on my kind of closing remarks here. But in the meantime, folks, mark your calendars for Wednesday at 4:15. Representative Hertas, you had a question, sir.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. Thanks. Mr. Rudling, I just wanted to make sure I understand exactly what you were saying. I maybe got a little confused in the middle of what you're talking about, but I think I took away that you are, like Mr. Joel Carlson, are in support of the hospitality industry and the lodging and not wanting to see those intermediaries having to collect the tax. Is that correct?
Mr. Rumling, if you're on the line, we can unmute you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
We can. Please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas. To be clear, the City of Bloomington supports the changes in the bill as presented today. We are in support of the hospitality industry, the local hotels, and we are in support of the local lodging tax being collected on the full compensation paid by people booking hotel rooms and such. And so if you book a $100 hotel room on Marriott.com, or if you book it on Expedia, you should pay them the same local lodging tax. It shouldn't matter how you book your hotel room. You should always pay the same amount of tax. Equalize the tax base no matter how you book the room. That's our main message, which helps out the local Minnesota hospitality industry, cities, and convention and visitors bureaus.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for that clarification, because when you sounded like you were in support of the hospitality industry, I know that with travel being severely restricted, the Mega Mall, certainly loss of customers in your home city as well, and I know that a number of people, whenever you travel around the country, it's kind of a landmark. They refer to, oh, yeah, Minnesota, where the Mega Mall is, and people, you know, will take weekend junkets to fly to Minneapolis just to visit the Mega Mall and do their shopping. So as we come out of this COVID-19 and the retail crisis that is occurring, while others are able to take advantage of it, such as the big box stores and the online ordering, such as Prime and Amazon and whatever, we need to get these retail industries back to full capacity again. And we're reading in the paper daily those who are filing for bankruptcy, those who are next to be out of business. And if we don't do something to support our retail local businesses, you won't have them anymore. And worse, as Mr. Egger probably would back me up, you'll have a high degree of vacancies in commercial real estate, which will drive their values down. And the values being driven down on commercial real estate will inevitably result in a shift of property taxes, a greater burden on homeowners as well. So we're facing a very big disruption as a result of this COVID-19. So I think I welcome the conversation this evening. I think we need to be careful about some of the things we're about to do and some of the enactments that we're considering, and do everything we can help for these small businesses. And many of you may think the Mega Mall is not a small business, but many of the tenants within that facility are. And whether they're a franchise or whatever, nonetheless, it's private capital, private investment that is shut down and closed. So just want to keep that all in mind. There's a reason why we exist as a property tax committee. And lastly, Mr. Chair, you know, the effort to have a working group, I think, is perhaps a good idea in some respects, but on the other hand, it's oftentimes an effort to diffuse the responsibility that really rests on our shoulders as legislators. And so the fact that this is going to happen, you know, that horse has been let out of the barn, and I hope that they take their mission seriously and come back with some good recommendations. But ultimately, whether they're accepted or partially or wholly or whatever the circumstance, this is going to have to come back to this committee, and certainly have to consider the important enactments. The last thing I will say with regard to the efforts on the lost provisions, and I've had conversations with you privately, Mr. Chair, as well as Chair Marquardt. Some of us have served on this committee for 8 years or longer. We've seen a lot of things come and go, but I guess I would just kind of reflect back on the premise of why the Minnesota miracle happened in the first place. There were, you know, back then, a lot of local communities wanting to exercise local option sales taxes. And in an effort to share the wealth and to create a level playing field so you didn't have different rates of taxation all over the state, so was embraced in a bipartisan way the Minnesota miracle. Somehow along the way, over the many years, there gets to be an exception. And the first exception was the corruption of the Minnesota Miracle Formula, where the money was somewhat equally distributed on a per capita basis throughout the state. Over time, the formulas changed, and one by one, cities were no longer eligible for LGA. So it's understandable, really, that many communities are coming back with requests for local option sales taxes. But it gets back to the problem that was solved a long time ago. And now that we have most of the cities on LGA, but roughly 12% of them are not,
It's interesting, as I watch these loss provisions come through our doors, that a preponderance, not all of them, but a preponderance of the loss provision requests are from cities who are already getting this other pot of money, the local government aid, which was supposed to spread the wealth and prepare them for the things that were going to be needed as far as critical infrastructure. So I'm just going to let it go at that. We'll save this for debate when the actual bill is heard, and we'll have more comments. But I think it's certainly something to think about, and I'll end it there, and thank you for the discussion this evening.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Members, please note that there are, in addition to the testifiers we heard from today, there are numerous letters that you will find posted online stating different positions on things. Please do take a moment to read those. Those are as equally as important as the testimony we heard today. In addition to just a tie-in on the last part of the conversation there from Representative Hertaus. Representative Hertaus, there is a letter from Hospitality Minnesota included in there in their support of the local lodging language. So that's in there as well. Members, thank you. Thank you for your work today. Again, we'll be back at this on Wednesday at 4:15 p.m., so keep an eye on your email. That's going to be a chance for some more discussion and mark up the bill. All right, here's what I need from folks. We don't have the 24-hour rule for amendments here in this committee, but I am asking under these unique circumstances that if you can please get your amendments submitted at least 2 hours before the hearing. So if you can get, you know, if you can get your amendments in by 2 o'clock on Wednesday to Mr. Jessen, that would be very much appreciated. Nathan's had to work hard enough working with a new chair. Let's try to not make his life any more difficult. So don't do it for me. Do it for Mr. Jessen, please. But seriously, members, if you want serious consideration for your amendments, please try to get those in a timely way. So that's my appeal to your sensibilities on that. Let's see, what else do I need to report out to you guys? And again, I will be following that same same protocols with an author's amendments submitted in advance and get that posted in a timely way as well. Members, again, thank you so much. Do look forward to hearing all of you on Wednesday of this week. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.